top stories this hour. Iran urges the European side in the Vienna talks to consider its red lines and avoid using media hype to sway the negotiations. Hamas commends the Palestinian nation for putting up a courageous struggle against acts of terror committed by Israeli settlers in the occupied east of Quds. Plus, Mali's military government tells France it need not wait several months before pulling out its troops, saying they should leave immediately. Hello, welcome. Your world news come to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Begin with our top story this hour. Iran's foreign minister has urged the European parties to the 2015 deal not to make any miscalculations as intensive talks are underway in Vienna for the revival of the accord. Hossein Amir Abdullahian advises the Europeans not to damage the negotiations with media campaigns. It says the European sides should keep in mind Iran's red lines in the talks and help restore Tehran's legitimate rights. He made the comments at a meeting with German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference. Baerbock says all parties should make every effort to pass through the current phase and open a new chapter in their engagement. The talks, now in their eighth round, aim to revive the 2015 multilateral deal from which the U.S. withdrew 4 years ago. Fuadi Zadia, professor of international studies at the University of Tehran, says the Europeans are spreading propaganda about the Vienna to get concessions from Iran.
As we get closer to the end of negotiations and JCPOA, you're going to see these type of tactics. The idea behind this particular tactic is that if you say that we are reaching an agreement, that puts pressure on the other side to accept your proposals, because the general feeling is that an agreement is very near. And that's a way of getting concessions from the other side. So that's one aspect of this story. The second aspect is called the blame game, which is designed to put the responsibility for the failure of the negotiations on the other side, saying that it was the demands that Iran made that resulted in not reaching an agreement. That's what they call when they talk about the blame game. That's another tactic that's going to be used.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has had other meetings on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference in Germany. He has discussed various issues, including the situation in Afghanistan, with UN Chief Antonio Guterres. Amir Abdullahian and Guterres called for the formation of an inclusive government in Afghanistan. The Iranian official said the formation of such a government that enjoys the participation of all political groups is essential for resolving the problems of Afghanistan. Amir Abdullahian also stressed the need for continued humanitarian assistance in Afghanistan. The country is facing a dire humanitarian situation as several Western countries have stopped giving it financial assistance in the wake of the Taliban takeover last August. A recent U.S. decision to seize half of Afghan frozen funds is expected to make the situation worse. Farahi Yousef is a Belfast-based author and journalist. He believes the war on Afghanistan was an imperialistic agenda and that the West has no humanitarian consideration for that country. Let's take a listen.
I think if America and the West had any humanitarian considerations whatsoever, they never would have instigated the war on terror, the war on the Muslim faith, and the war on Afghanistan. I think the destruction of Afghanistan is quite simply the imperialist capitalist cabal in Washington and in NATO continuing the 19th century form of resource theft from countries that are vulnerable to Western white imperialist military superpowers. I think Iran should be congratulated. I think Iran has shown great patience. It has shown a great observation to the human values and the sanctity of human life. I think it's very important that people realize that the West has no intention of coming to the aid of Afghanistan, and it should take other countries that are connected to the United Nations, and I would specifically encourage China to come to the aid of Afghanistan, because China is the complete polar opposite of American imperialism.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is urging Arab and Muslim nations to shoulder their joint responsibility to defend the city of Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque against Israeli aggression. In a statement marking the World Quds Week, the movement says the occasion is the best opportunity to keep the Palestinian cause alive at an international level. Hamas says all political and media forums should be utilized to attain that end. The movement has praised the Palestinian nation's struggles to defend Al-Quds against Israeli atrocities as well as acts of terror by settlers. The statement comes amid heightened tensions in an East Al-Quds neighborhood. Israel has been trying to evict Palestinian families forcibly from Sheikh Jarrah in favor of settlers. Joining me from Ramallah to discuss this story further is Saad Nimr. He is a professor of political science at Birzeit University. Thank you so much for joining Press TV. I want to know what you make of this statement that says the occasion is an opportunity to renew allegiance to Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Yes, indeed. It is an opportunity, especially now, that we need all the help that we can get from the Muslim world as well as from Arab world and the international community in general. What we mean by this, because now Jerusalem is being under a huge attack by the settlers and by this also colonialist government to evacuate Jerusalem and to control Al-Aqsa Mosque. And I don't think that there will be another chance as much as the best of this chance to have an action by the Muslim world regarding, you know, defending the Al-Aqsa Mosque. What we mean by that is not a condemnation statements or, you know, criticism to what the Israeli are doing, but rather to gather in a kind of an action that would affect the occupation and show them that this government, this colonialist government in Israel, that the world can take action, such as to reactivate the boycott of all Muslim countries to the Israeli products and Israeli to deal with Israel and to boycott them in all aspects, whether it's cultural, political, and even economical. And that would show that there is a seriousness in the Arab world and in the Muslim world that they are not going to let this colonial government of doing what they are doing in Jerusalem, especially now trying to evacuate Sheikh Jarrah, and before that it's Silwan and all other Wadi al-Humus. It's all the neighborhoods in East Jerusalem being under attack.
And one more thing, what's happening in East Al-Quds in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, especially what happened last week, appears to be unifying Palestinians, don't you think so?
Well, yes, definitely. Now all the Palestinians are unified for Sheikh Jarrah, and everyone is trying, you know, to do their best. And we have witnessed in the last week so many clashes with the Israeli occupation in so many villages and towns because of the what's going on in Sheikh Jarrah. In most of the Palestinian areas, Palestinians are unified towards the issue of Sheikh Jarrah and towards Jerusalem. This is a unifying factor, and I believe we should even take it further, that it is needed now for all Palestinian factions to be unified, mm-hmm. and especially when we are talking about Hamas and Fatah and the Palestinian Authority, to reunify all our efforts in order to be able to confront the Israeli settlers and the Israeli government. Otherwise, they are benefiting out of this separation between Gaza, West Bank, between Hamas, Fatah, and the Palestinian factions. Right. We urgently need a real unification by these Palestinian factions, all of them, to be unified against this aggression. We hope that the Algerian initiative now to gather the Palestinian factions and try to have a kind of a reconciliation between all Palestinian factions to be successful this time in order to be able to confront the Israeli measures.
Professor, thank you so much. I've been talking to Professor Satin Nimmer, a professor of political science from Brzezet University. Thank you so much. And now it's time for our news review program, where we discuss one of our top stories in some length with our guests. Welcome to the news review program. Mali's ruling military junta renews its calls for the immediate withdrawal of French troops from the African country.
In the light of repeated breaches of defense agreements, the Malian government asks French authorities to withdraw without delay Barkhane and Takuba forces from the national territory under the supervision of the Malian authorities.
The spokesman has questioned France's plan to pull out its forces over several months. He has also described as unsatisfactory the results of the French-led military engagement in the Sahel state for nearly 9 years. French President Emmanuel Macron says Paris and its European and African allies would withdraw their troops from Mali in what he calls an orderly fashion. Macron rejects the criticism that France has failed in its former colony. Relations between the two countries have been strained since 2020, for the coup in Mali in 2020, France deployed troops there in 2013 under the pretext of fighting terrorists, but the operations have failed to quell violence and led to public discontent. Let me welcome our guest to this edition of News Review. On the line from Paris, we have Ramin Mazahiri, our correspondent, and also Mostafa Fatouri, an academic and journalist. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us in this edition of News Review. Let me ask this first question from Mostafa Fatouri. Is the Sahel region in general, and Mali in particular, any safer today than it was back in 2013?
Thank you for having me, first of all. Not at all. I think the security situation in the Sahel region, extending from all the way to in the east to Sudan, is less stable, less secure than it was in 2013, when first France sent its troops to fight what it calls jihadists and terrorist groups. So the whole area has been, I wouldn't say mainly because of the French military intervention, but that was a contributing factor. The whole area has been destabilized much worse than it was. The number of attacks by terrorist groups has increased and has been a trans-border problem, not only in Mali, but we have seen it in Niger, we have seen it in Burkina Faso especially, where there has been a recent military takeover, mainly for this reason of lack of security. So the same problem is existing in Chad in a different form. And then all the way to Sudan, probably the contagion, the effect will continue. So not at all. It has not been any better in that area.
Thank you. Ramin, is France really serious in saying that it will leave Mali? Because some people believe that France is going to use this as a bargaining chip in negotiations with the ruling military junta in Mali, and it's only a continuation of its neocolonialist agenda.
Right. Well, this is a major blow to what's known as France-Afrique. As Mostafa mentioned, you have Burkina Faso, you have Guinea, you have Chad, Niger, all these places that have had, where the heads of states have been seized. France likes to believe that it's in some sort of dominant position, but it's clearly not the case at all democratically. The people of Mali were protesting France's military presence in the country. In a case of either incredible arrogance or stupidity, France's sanctions on Mali have raised food prices. So the Malians themselves have made it emphatically clear that they want France gone. The war has gone so badly that Malians openly accused France of arming the rebels. So there's a reason why this has been dubbed France's Afghanistan. And then I should point out that France has blamed all of these problems on Russian disinformation But Mali in public opinion, as I said, there was a poll last year in the capital of Bamako that said that 80% of respondents believe that France is only there for their own interests, for France's own interests. So clearly there is this massive democratic response against France. And what we're looking at now is this going to turn into, or is this going to keep being France's Afghanistan? Meaning, will there be protests to force out a rapid and humiliating withdrawal, exactly like what happened to the U.S.-led coalition in Afghanistan? Mm-hmm. Macron is saying that he wants 6 months there. He believes, as you said, this is going to be a bargaining chip, and France is going to do whatever they can to protect their business interests, which are mainly about energy. France is the most dependent country, major country on nuclear power, and Mali is thought to have a lot of uranium deposits. So is this, we will have to see what happens. We have seen this historic forcing out of the ambassador and this historic democratic demand that France leaves. Can they last 6 more months, or will we see protests just like in Afghanistan force out the French army into a humiliating retreat? That is something that we'll just have to wait and see.
Let me ask Mustapha Feturi. The question is, if France has concluded to withdraw, why is it now waiting for another 6 to 12 months? Why not leave now?
Well, it has two ways options, as our colleague mentioned earlier from Paris, that France doesn't want any kind of portrayal if its departure from Mali, being seen as to what happened in the in Kabul, to the U.S. in Kabul last August. That was very chaotic situation. That was very disastrous, BR if you like, and militarily, of course, it was a disaster. So the French don't want that. And we have to remember here that Mr. Macron is facing elections April, just a little than 2 months from now. And he wanted to portray his policy in Africa, of course, across the continent, across the former French colonies, as a success. So he wants to say that I do things from my point of view and my schedule and my timing. I do not give in to anybody, especially the new rulers, you know, as they call them in France, in Mali, who took over power a year ago. So it's a kind of, okay, we are leaving. That's what the French are saying. But we are leaving in our own terms. And I do expect them to have their troops out by the election time in April.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on this edition of News Review. I've been talking to Rami Mazohiri, our correspondent in Paris, and Mustapha Feturi, an academic and journalist also from Paris.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
aperture.
A visit to Iran yields a stunning variety of culinary delights. There's a vast spectrum of foods flourishing for centuries and evolving since Achaemenid times. Persian cooking incorporates many flavors into its uniquely delicious food traditions. A taste of Persia's food can be identified by its sumptuous rice dishes, its intriguing and delicate flavors, and its combination of herbs, spice, fruit, and nuts. And one integral component to Persian cuisine is the use of saffron, the world's most expensive spice, which gives Iranian food its distinct flavor and aroma and golden hue. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Many coveted ingredients are native to Iran, including pistachios, almonds, walnuts, pomegranates, grapes, and perhaps most notably, saffron. Iran has a variable climate with four distinct seasons. The ancient Persians transformed vast stretches of arid land into fertile oases through underground aquifers that drew melted snow water into the desert. And thus, a bright, sensuous, fruit and herb-filled cuisine was born. This week on Aperture, we will follow Javad Gharayi as he explores the amazing deserts of South Khorasan province and visits a charming little village where saffron, the world's most highly prized spice, is grown. Don't miss the first part.
This time, I leave the cold winter weather in the capital city for the beautiful desert flower farms. My destination is the outskirts of South Khorasan province, an area famous for its saffron, Iran's prized red gold. Iran is one of the most mountainous countries in the world, covered by rugged mountain ranges and deserts. 61% of the country has a dry climate. Deserts cover a combined area of around 34 million hectares, scattered among 18 of its provinces. That means around 30% of the country is made up of vast deserts featuring many mountains, salt pans, and sand dunes. Deserts across the world share almost the same features. Little precipitation, intense evaporation of water due to the scorching sun, smothering heat, dry air, great temperature fluctuations, poor vegetation, and a dearth of adequate organic compounds in the soil. However, despite the hostile climate of the deserts of Iran, life is in progress on their margins. I'm Javad Gharayi. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm taking you on a journey to the most pristine areas of my beloved country and showing you their many beauties. Before visiting the saffron grove, I decide to take a look around at the desert surroundings on the outskirts of South Khorasan province. To that end, I begin my journey with Halwan Desert, located within 90 kilometers of Tabas, a city in and the capital of Tabas County, in the northwest of South Khorasan. Because of its distance from the urban areas, the natural beauties of deserts are not known to humans as much as they should. If you want to venture out into the desert in order to admire its matchless beauties, you'd have to choose the right season and the right time of day. From a distance, deserts and the wilderness don't seem all that beautiful. Once you've set foot in them, you feel as if you've stepped into a veritable heaven. But a different kind of heaven, You don't see forests with tall trees, grass, or running water. All you can see is streams with very salty water, single salt cedars and saxholes, scattered shrubs and bushes in the landscape, camels and other species unique to this hot and dry climate. It's very beautiful and peaceful here, but that's not always the case. Within minutes, this whole area can turn into an ominously stormy ocean. Ferocious storms of sand and dust that have buried many a caravan and traveler over the course of centuries. In the not-too-distant past, some of Iran's deserts were inhabited by people living in this climate. But thanks to global warming and decreased precipitation that led to drinking water wells drying and parts of the vegetation dying, the people living in such areas were forced to leave their little villages for a better place. Today, those villages lay in ruins on their original locations, ruins that now serve as shelters for the camel herders against the blazing sun. But these homes of yesterday are still as beautiful as ever. Deserts around the world are expanding by the year. Desert expansion or desertification is a result of global warming, the growth in the human population, unplanned agriculture and excessive firewood collection, depletion of subterranean water resources, industrial contaminants and excessive use of fossil fuels, overgrazing by livestock, and the change in the use of agricultural land. This conversion of habitable and fertile land to uninhabitable desert can happen naturally due to a drought, or can be caused by human activities. Activities that have disturbed the balance of nature on planet Earth. Iran accounts for more than 2% of the world's drought. It's also home to more than 8% of the deserts and arid lands that contain no vegetation, and that is considered a big number. But in the fringes of this same hot and dry desert, meaning the one in South Khorasan, there are mountains that supply the rivers and khanats in this area with drinking water. Streams that could be regarded as the natural wonders of this otherwise parched region. Taht-e-Arus, or the Bride's Throne, near the village of Izmiran on the Tabas-Mashhad Road, is a befitting name for this stream. The flowing water reminds me of the celebrations held by people in the old times upon the discovery of clean, fresh water in a hot and dry region. Only those born and bred in a dry climate with limited resources of fresh water appreciate its true value. People who have endured thirst, have felt the baking heat from the sun on their skin, and may have seen rain coming down from the skies over their heads only once a year. The people of Izmiran fit that profile perfectly. God has bestowed upon them fresh water in a stream gushing out of the dry desert mountains around Tebas. And the people here have utmost appreciation for this most precious of God's blessings in the heart of the natural world. In the distant past, the people of Izmiran lived in dwellings carved into mountain wall. With the tools they had, they would dig deep vertical and horizontal holes into the side of the mountains. In them, they'd carve out rooms where they'd live. In the past, these hand-carved chambers were referred to as looms. desert people are very smart. Using the water from the stream and the fertile soil here, they've been farming rice for generations. Today, the rice produced in Esmiran is among the best in the country. Who would believe there are paddy fields in the middle of a desert and among these mountains? Everybody thinks rice is only grown in the north of Iran. But where does the stream go on this dry land after irrigating the paddy fields of Esmiran? Does it sink into the arid terrain in the areas surrounding the rice farms? That can't be the case, because to the desert dwellers, fresh water is worth more than diamonds. The locals in this area have spoken to me of a formidable yet beautiful canyon and helped me see the rest of the course that the water from Takhtiaru spring takes. The name of that canyon is Kala Jenny, the Canal of Jinns, shaped by water movement and erosion over centuries. I'm going to step into a canyon where the water from Takhtiaru spring is flowing, but the volume of the water is not large enough to make it to the end of this very long course without going to waste. I'm curious to know how that water continues on its path in the dry land and where it eventually gets to. It's simply beautiful. As I said, the name of the awe-inspiring canyon is Kala Jenny. On its bottom, water from the Takhtiaru spring of Tabaz is moving as we speak. Most of the way, the water flows between the two walls of this canyon, just like it does in a Qanat, and springs out of the underground near Tabaz. It's one of the most beautiful sights to see around the city of Tabaz in South Khorasan province. The Canal of Jinns. That's a scary name. Kala Jenny was shaped so beautifully by water movements, such as seasonal rain-induced floodwaters over thousands or millions of years. It kind of looks like the Grand Canyon in the U.S., though it doesn't share the same depth. It really is stunning. After a long walk in the mountains, I arrive at the upper end of the canyon. From up here, it's a spectacular deep gorge. I explore the canyon as much as I can and as long as there is nothing to threaten my life. But as I walk the length of it, water from Takhtiaru spring is nowhere to be found most of the way. The locals have already given me valuable information about that, but to see everything firsthand, I have to walk down to the bottom of the valley, and I do so with gusto and caution. One of the things that renders Kala Jenny even more remarkable is its pristineness. Not many nature travelers come here. Unfortunately, those who do don't leave behind any kind of waste or garbage. And that has turned this canyon into one of the most must-see natural sites in the Tabaz area. There are qanats here. In some places, water has pushed its way out, but there are still other qanats inside walls that continue all the way to the villages of Tabaz. And this water originates from the Takhtiaru spring in Esmiran province. It's the same water that's come all the way here and has welled out. In the absence of plumbing in the past, they would channel fresh water from one village to another or from the mountains to their villages and farms by means of a qanat system, and they did it to prevent the water from going to waste. This one here is one of those qanats. Out on the bottom of the canyon, the water would sink into the ground, so they channeled the water downhill through a series of gently sloping tunnels along several kilometers to the places where it was needed for irrigation and domestic use. Although new qanats are seldom built today, many old ones are still used in Iran and have until recently served as one of the main reasons behind the continuation of life in areas with hot and dry climates. New technology has in recent years led to a rapid depletion of the underground water reservoirs, but we can still think of reviving the qanat water supply system, take advantage of this millennia-old experience for agricultural purposes in Iran, and do something to make it happen. I knew very well that the rainfall in the eastern regions of the country is less than half the rain that falls in the western regions. Therefore, water is much more valuable in this part of the country. The people living in these parts have always been thinking of innovative ways of harnessing water and managing its resources. Digging anats and channeling underground water onto the surface was very common in Iran. They didn't cost much, and they were very efficient. Anats offered several advantages. Firstly, they prevent the sun from shining directly at the water and making it evaporate. Secondly, moving inside the mountains, not much of the water is absorbed by the bed and walls of the channel. And thirdly, the water is immune to any and all kinds of contamination and flows to its destination clean and cool. What's certain is that humans wouldn't have been able to survive in the desert areas if they hadn't built the anats. Almost all researchers believe that the world's first anats were built in areas under Iran's cultural influence. No one knows for sure why the ancient dwellers of this region named this gorge the Kali Jinni, but apparently some of them believe this canyon was haunted by jinns or ghosts. There were others who believed the idea of digging holes and caves into the mountainside for safety was something that even ghosts wouldn't have been able to come up with. Or maybe the reason why this canyon was named the Canal of Jinns was the roaring seasonal floodwaters that swept along this canyon and still do today. Whatever the name, it must have been chosen for a reason. It defies belief that there is so much water in the Kali Jinni Canyon. To the people of southern Khorasan province, each drop of this water is worth as much as a kilo of saffron, and this canyon has a lot of it. It looks like someone has chiseled away at the rocks. The only sound you can hear in the mountains is that of the water rippling along the anats. Eventually, I get to a point in the canyon where the ancient dwellers of this land redirected the water from the surface to a canal inside the mountain. This is where the water is redirected underground. It was the brainchild of folks who lived here in the distant past, and that beautiful anat dug inside the wall of the canyon carries water to the villages lying on the outskirts of Tabas. The locals have told me different things about the cavities and man-made holes inside the Kali Jinni. Apparently, no one has accurate information on the age of those cave-like shelters. But tales of how they came to be have been passed down from one generation to another. I spend hours scouring the canyon for those man-made tunnels, and I finally find them. It is hard to believe how these tunnels were hand-carved at this height. Niches that acted as footholds to help them climb some 5 or 6 meters to get to the chambers above, where they are likely to have lived. And that was where they felt safe. It's still not clear why these tunnels, these wells and these chambers were dug into the walls of this canyon and at this height by the people in the past. But many believe they actually lived here. This was the perfect place for people to take shelter in and survive the stifling heat of the Tabas region. And there are many others who believe this was a place where the village dwellers around here, who wanted to steer clear of the brigands and looters, would transfer all their valuable belongings. They themselves would hide here too, along with their belongings, and wait for the looters to leave the area. Of course, there are also others who are of the opinion that these tunnels were just the right place for the people of that time to come to and worship their gods. That in fact they considered this place as their place of worship. They call it the Canal of Jinns for a reason. It can get really scary in some parts. And it's obvious that torrential floodwaters have shaped this valley like this over the years. In fact, what those floodwaters did was wash away the dirt and stones on their path. Of course, it might have taken millions of years for this canyon to take on the shape it has today. It's frightening to be here and walking on the bottom flanked by tall walls. It looks endless to me. I've been walking these smaller gorges near Kalajini for hours, but it looks like there is no end in sight. I haven't been able to get to the other end of any of them. The deeper you go inside, you realize you have more to go. This is a completely virgin valley with no traces whatsoever of human activity in it. Usually, garbage is the first sign of human presence in the natural world. It's clear to me that only people who feel responsible to nature have been to this area before. That is because there is no trash on the ground and no writings on the walls. That has made my trip into the heart of the canyon ever more worthwhile and helped me appreciate its magnificence more intensely. My visit to the Kalajini Canyon has come to an end. I got to see beautiful sights in the canyon from different angles. The canyon has a scary name, but that didn't change my mind about traveling right into it and exploring it. I continue my trek in the desert, this time to see the desert flower, commonly known as the saffron crocus. That means an approximately 200-kilometer walking distance from the Kalajini Canyon. On my way there, the imposing ruins of an ancient building grab my attention. They are the remains of a desolate village by the name of Dihuk. Iranian deserts always have wonderful surprises for travelers, and this beautiful ancient village is one of them. What really tugs at my heartstrings, though, is that the villagers have abandoned these buildings with their unique architecture for brick-and-mortar homes. It saddens me to see traditional Iranian architecture consigned to oblivion by my fellow Iranians in cities and villages. Today, Iranian architecture that encompasses life and vitality, art and aesthetic beauties, and love and positive energy is being replaced by ghastly steel and mortar structures. Architecture that's alien to the Persian culture. Architecture that bears no signs of the ancient Persian culture and doesn't include the freshness, the gardens, the water pools, and other natural features characteristic of traditional Persian architecture. Such homes do not belong in our country, and I wish they had never been built. In my opinion, this ancient village is one of the most beautiful villages I've ever seen in this area. The people here, I mean the people who used to live here, call this village Ancient Dihuk. Now, they live in a small township by the same name, built around 20 to 25 years ago. It was built after the earthquake in the year 1978. So now they call this place Old Dihuk, which, as I say, is one of the most beautiful villages on the margins of the Lut Desert.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for tuning in and thank you for listening to this program for a better life with me, Javed Akbari. Now, brothers and sisters, in this episode, I'm going to discuss with you another stage of nafs. In the previous two or three episodes, I discussed the different levels of nafs. I talked about the importance of self-knowledge, first of all, and then I talked about nafs-e-ammara and then Nafs Lawama, and then we have the Nafs Mutmainna, which we are going to explore in this stage. Now, Nafs Mutmainna, of course, has been translated as the secure self or the certain self. You know, some people have translated as soul in complete rest and complete satisfaction. There is a verse in the Holy Quran, verse 27 and 28 of Surah Al-Fajr, which you can read, of course, for yourself, but I will read it for you. يَا أَيَّتُهَا النَّفْسُ الْمُطْمَئِنَّ إِرْجَعِي إِلَىٰ رَبِّكِ رَاضِيَةً مَرْضِيَّ. O thou soul, in complete rest and satisfaction, return to your Lord, well-pleased with Him, well-pleasing Him. So the main point which we are going to talk about and elaborate is النَّفْسُ الْمُطْمَئِنَّ. Dear brothers and sisters, it's important to know ourselves to understand His relationship to Allah. He who knows himself has known his Lord. This is what we talked in the previous episode. The verse of the Holy Quran, which I just recited, refers to yet another level of nafs, which is nafs mutmainna, or the nafs which is at rest. It is the nafs which is at peace. It is the self or the nafs that has ascended to the first station of development towards intimacy, contentment, and love for Allah. Nafs mutmainna is the nafs whose refinement is attained through increasing commitment and through honest and sincere fulfillment of obligations with respect to the true way. Now, the human soul, the human nafs, at this stage is set on the right path, and it is traversing the path towards perfection, the path towards goodness and virtue. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Nafsi mutmainna, or the secure self, has entered the pathways, the methods and means of protection and healing through self-examination, resistance and striving and devotion. That is where this Nafsi mutmainna is, because it has come all the way from Nafsi Ammara, from Nafsi Lawwama to Nafsi Mutmainna. You know, it is in a position to examine itself, to heal itself, and to resist, to strive, and to devote. These efforts bear the fruit of certainty in the truth that Allah alone is the actor. Allah alone is the Lord, is the sustainer, and Allah alone is the provider. He is the whole and soul actor. He is the cause and motivator of everything, because there is no God but Him and no Lord but Him. And of course, Allah in all of His actions is merciful and generous. He knows the best interests of the nafs or self. Now this certainty, this itminan, of course, which comes from the nafs, leads to trust in Allah. The self, the nafs, becomes confident that what is with Allah is better and more enduring than what ever is in the position of nafs or in the position of others. So the self becomes secure and ceases to occupy itself with anything other than Allah, the Almighty. So it's occupied with Allah and it rests in peace. It is certain. And that's why it's called Nafs Mutmainna. And of course, the Urafa, the mystics, and of course, Shi'i scholars have gone to a great length explaining this level of nafs. Allama Tabatabai, for example, considers this nafs, nafs mutmainna, or maybe the confident soul or nafs, to be one that has attained peace by relying on God. It is satisfied with God's pleasure, and it is satisfied with the ups and downs of life. And these ups and downs of life have no effect on it. Everybody obviously has ups and downs. There are bitter experiences, there are happy experiences. But these experiences have no effect on the nafs. Now, such a person with such a soul, with such a nafs, is in complete servitude and does not deviate from the right path. This is the characteristic of the nafsi mutmainna, or the secure self. Now, you can go, if you understand, of course, tafsir, the Farsi or Arabic, you can go to Al-Mizan, volume 20, page 285. Unfortunately, the tafsir Al-Mizan has not been completely translated. The translation is underway and it is being translated. The first few volumes have been translated thanks to some great scholars who have endeavored to translate this voluminous book. Tafsir, of course. Nafs mutmainna is the first level of maturity for the self. The heart begins to shine with the light of consciousness. The ego's power begins to shrink so that purity, refinement, clarity, and light dominate the heart. The self begins to show its true attributes that were previously hidden. These are the attributes of servitude, or budiyya, you know, helplessness, ajz, you know. All the power belongs to Allah. And these are attributes of humility, the attribute of poverty, you know, non-attachment, faqr. And these are the attributes of need, ihtiyaj, and annihilation, fana. You know, these are some very concepts which someone who understands and who covers the stages and levels of the nafs reaches a level where he considers himself as someone who is annihilated, and who is completely poor, who is completely helpless, and who considers himself as being a pure servant. Now, he is under the command of his human soul, which takes pleasure in following the example of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. He possesses the qualities which Allah praises. He is kind, he is generous, he is patient, he is forgiving, he is sincere, thankful, he is content, and he is at peace. Now, the self is characterized by all these positive attributes at this level of the nafs, and which is why it is at peace. The nafs is constantly remembering Allah, and it is tranquil, it is at peace. Allah bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub. And that's another verse which you can find in the Quran. In short, brothers and sisters, an nafs al mutmainna is the noblest and highest soul compared to other stages, because this soul is, this nafs is always in the truth without the slightest doubt. That's all for this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, and every word I share, he knows. Allah knows.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.